Good morning. So, happy days today. Did you know that today is National Twins Day? It's not really, I'm just kidding you. But I am kind of curious. I just got to ask this question. No more laughter in my class. I just need to know, how many of you are twins? Okay, very good. I'm not even going to ask them. You're making that up. Serious. Oh, my goodness. Goodness. Lots of twins around here. I'm not going to ask how many are identical and not, because I don't want to know if you've been substituting on me. Very good. It is not National Twins Day, so don't get terribly excited. But you have some announcements. So the homework is finally out there. The homework that you turned in last Friday got put out last night. So it's there. You can stop by and pick it up. The grading key is listed out there. I had to go through and regrade one of the questions, so you'll maybe find different colored ink scratches and so forth. If you wonder, why did your grade go up? It's because I made it go up. Almost everybody's grade went up when I went through, except for a couple of unfortunate people. So I won't talk about that one either. Lab, remember, is a little bit unusual. I should just say your lab homework is a little bit unusual because you've got two things that you're doing. Now, once you come out of lab, you've got the regular lab homework assignment that's due at the regular time, whatever that might be. And then you're also evaluating another group's paper. And that isn't due until you meet next time. So two different things going on. One thing, due at the regular time. The other thing, not due until you meet the next time. And I would remind you that as part of that evaluation, not only can you please make comments on the paper that you're evaluating, but there's a page in the lab manual for you to fill out to help you maybe in thinking about helping these people to produce a better final product. And so that needs to get filled out also. I think it's page 69, if I'm not mistaken. What you need to do is bring two of those to lab with you, two copies of that. So once you've filled it out, you need to be sure and make a copy of that, because your lab instructor is going to keep a copy, and one of those copies is going to go on the paper, and then the groups will get their papers back. Yeah?
Do you want our names, like the graders, do you want our names on the paper?
I need your name on one copy, but not the copy that's... So one copy, but not both, because we want it to be anonymous for the evaluation.
Okay.
So the one that goes with that will not have a name on it, and the one that... your instructor keeps will have a name on it.
Okay.
So that we know who did it. Okay. So that's lab, a little bit, only slightly confusing, I hope, there. Don't forget, second creative assignment, if you owe me a creative assignment, is due a week from today at the beginning of lecture. You don't have to wait until a week from today to turn it in. If you want to turn it in early, if you want to drop it by my office or something, you're more than welcome to do that. But by the beginning of lecture next Thursday, that's when that creative assignment is due. And then finally, the third quiz opens today, at 5 o'clock, runs through tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Again, there are the materials that it's covering, the study questions that are pertinent, that you find the review questions in the lecture note packet, labs 4 and 5, so the lab on diffusion osmosis that we did, and then the lab on enzymes that we did. Lab 6 could be thrown in, but that was your lab, right? So the labs 4 and 5, basically. And I got one more question and answer session today at 12:15 in the lab room. So if you would like to come by and ask your questions and listen to the answers, you're more than welcome to do that. Well, if you can't make it then, and you have questions, you're more than welcome to stop by my office. At other times, later this afternoon, I will be gone. But I'll be there most of the afternoon, or call me or something, and I'll be glad to answer questions that you might have. So that wonderful event is today. It's opening today, closing tomorrow. Okay? So, what did we do last time? We finished up our examination, actually, of cellular respiration. We had looked at the carbon reactions also looked at the electron reactions. We talked about some other things associated with that. And I want to put this back up here one last time, not to torture you, but there are a couple of points that I want to make, a point that I failed to make that I want to make here in just a second. So we talked about things that can happen, right? Like why do we need the oxygen in the first place? When you write out that reaction, C6H12O6 plus 6 oxygen goes to form 6 CO2 and 6 waters. Why do we need that oxygen? Well, it's not so we can make carbon dioxide. It's so that we can accumulate and get rid of these low-energy electrons, right? So what happens if there's no oxygen present? We talked about how everything will back up, and rapidly will back up, and fairly quickly this whole process will shut down, right? Because not only are we not moving the electrons through the electron transport chain, so we're getting no energy from that, we're no longer able to reoxidize the electron carriers, so that's what shuts this down. Wherever there's a coupled reaction and we need to extract high-energy electrons, if we don't have the carriers to do it, that means that's not going to happen, so the whole thing just backs up and shuts down. Right, so that's why you die of asphyxiation in your brain cells fairly quickly. That will happen. And once we run out of ATP, then that's it. You can't maintain the integrity of the cell. You can't keep things going on that need to go on. And the cells begin to die. So we talked about certain specialized tissue that can keep that going. So we talked about this process that we call anaerobic fermentation. Anaerobic, no oxygen fermentation. And we talked about how in the skeletal muscle, we have enzymes that will allow us to convert that pyruvic acid into lactic acid that doesn't show up on here. I think we're all familiar with lactic acid because, you know, if you haven't been exercising for a while and you go out and exercise a lot, your muscles burn, they ache and stuff, and then a lot of that has to do with lactic acid buildup. Right? As you get into better shape, you build better blood supply into your muscles, and so you're able to not only move more oxygen into the muscles so that you can kind of put off that oxygen debt for a while, but you're better able to move the lactic acid out of the muscles once you start to go into oxygen debt. So being in better shape really has benefits in terms of exercise there and keeping things moving around better. Anyway, form the lactic acid, the advantage of that was that they were reoxidizing the NAD. We can keep glycolysis going. And by keeping glycolysis going, we can keep some ATP production going. And because the cell has very closely regulates ATP levels, it'll just crank up the amount of glucose that's flowing through glycolysis to keep the ATP levels up as high as it can. So as long as we've got blood sugar available, or some of the precursors way out on this end of glycolysis, we can keep making ATP for kind of a short time longer, but hopefully long enough to get us past whatever has put us into oxygen debt to begin with. So that was in the humans we saw, and then we saw in yeast, they'll do a similar thing, though they have different kinds of enzymes that do different things, but the similar part of it is that they're going to do something to reoxidize that NAD back to NAD, or NADH back to NAD plus again. And as the byproduct of that, is that they actually give off carbon dioxide from the pyruvic acid and they form ethyl alcohol. And people over the years have learned to tame the yeast, to take advantage of the yeast, to put them to work as their yeast slaves to form alcohol. And so we talked about that a little bit. And if you keep the containers corked when you're making your wine, then it becomes carbonated and you get some form of champagne or something like that, sparkling wine. So there are means that cells have from time to time to kind of get past these periods of low oxygen. But you know, eventually it's going to catch up with you. And if you don't get the oxygen going back again, eventually it'll catch up, and that'll be the end of it anyway. We also talked about cyanide and how cyanide blocks the movement of low-energy electrons from the last cytochrome to oxygen. And so it's just no different from having no oxygen there. If you can't move the electrons into the oxygen, then everything's going to back up again. So that's cyanide. That's how it poisons you. Your cells start to die off because of that. We talked about dinitrophenol that uncouples ATP production, which in itself is a bad thing. I wouldn't recommend going out and getting a bottle of dinitrophenol and drinking it. That'd be very cool. But we talked about brown fat and how brown fat has that ability to uncouple also. And it's under close regulation so that we can keep the ATP reserves up. But when the ATP reserves up and the temperature goes down, decouple ATP production, get more electrons flowing through there, and capture the heat that's being released at every one of those steps where no reaction is 100% efficient, heat's being released. And so that helps to warm the body a little bit. So we talked about all of those different kinds of things. Now, the one thing that I failed to mention that I really wanted to mention has to do with exercise and aerobic versus anaerobic exercise. Okay, so you go to the gym and stuff, you take an aerobic exercise class maybe, what are you trying to do? Well, you're trying to get your heart rate up to a high enough level so that it's going to have some beneficial, some benefits to you, health benefits to you, but you don't want it at such a high level that you start going into oxygen debt, so that you start to go anaerobic. Now, why is that? Take a look at what's going on here. If we want to burn, what do we want to burn? If you want to burn fats especially, you cannot go into oxygen debt. You can't go anaerobic because the fats are metabolized. We talked about it. The fats are metabolized through the citric acid cycle. And so if you're breaking down fats for energy and you start to run out of oxygen, the citric acid cycle is going to shut down. And so you can no longer metabolize those fats. What can you metabolize? Well, sugars that you have in reserve and so forth, but not fats. So that's why it's important when you're exercising to try to maintain aerobic exercise rather than anaerobic. And it's generally estimated that as long as you're no higher than about 70% of your maximum heart rate, that you're functioning aerobically. Now, we could find that out. If we put a mask on someone and sampled the air that they were exhaling, we can tell when they go from aerobic to anaerobic, or when the anaerobic processes start to kick in, because we'll start to see a drop in CO2 production and so forth, and yet keeping the energy going. So there are ways to find out, and it's estimated, you know, around 70% or so, then you're okay. Sometimes you have to, you know, if you're a sprinter or something and you're out there, or you're playing football and you're trying to run down the field, or baseball, you know, sometimes you will run enough that maybe you will go into oxygen debt a little bit. But that's not what I'm talking about here. And again, the better shape that you're in, the longer it's going to take to go into oxygen debt, and the quicker you're going to come out of it. But what we're talking about here is kind of prolonged exercise. If you want to burn fats, you might think, oh man, the harder I work, the better it's going to be, up until about 70-80% of that maximum heart rate, and then you're going to start to lose the effect, and you're not going to be as happy with the results. Okay, so aerobic exercise keeps everything running, and fats are only metabolized under aerobic conditions. Okay, so that'd be that. Last time, then, we also started talking about photosynthesis, and I need to get into that this time, because not only do I want to finish our discussion of photosynthesis, which kind of gives you a clue that I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but there are some things I want to tell you about how we capture that energy, trap it, how we build it into the molecules that we need. But I'm hoping to be able to move in to start talking with you about DNA and things like that, too. So we're not going to talk about the structure, that you're getting that in the lab, and this week's and next week's lab that you're doing were specifically designed to be done before you had any introduction to DNA or things like that. Of course, a lot of you have been introduced to that sort of thing in the past in various classes you've taken, so some of it may seem familiar, some of it doesn't, and so forth, but they were specifically designed with that in mind. So anyway, let's talk about photosynthesis. So we're looking at what appears to be the reverse of respiration, cellular respiration. Right? We talked about how cellular respiration is very exergonic. We get a lot of energy out. We are using that energy to make more ATP, to keep things going. Well, if photosynthesis is the reverse, that means it's a very endergonic reaction, and we have to put energy in to make that happen. And with photosynthesis, photo, light, of course, we're going to get the energy to do that from the sun or from light. Generally, we think of the sun, but of course, now with electric lights and so forth, you can do it with other lights. As long as you got one of the things you really need if you're trying to grow plants under artificial light is a full spectrum of wavelengths. And oftentimes, like if you're just trying to grow plants under fluorescent lights, oftentimes they don't have a full spectrum, so they don't grow as well. And you have to throw some incandescent light in there to kind of capture some of the reds and so forth that the fluorescents don't have. Anyway, that's the reaction we're looking at. We're going to take some carbon dioxide and some water. We're going to convert that into sugar initially, into glucose, and oxygen is actually given off as a waste product of photosynthesis. And then plants are going to do all sorts of things with that glucose once they make it. They've got any number of things they can do with that to our benefit. So we're going to benefit from all of that stuff the plants are doing. We're not going to go into that kind of stuff. So we talked last time about how do we harvest that energy? What do we have to have? We talked about pigments. Molecules that are colored, and they're colored because they have a particular structure to them that allows them to absorb light energy. So when light is shown on these molecules, some of that energy gets absorbed. We talked about how the color really is what's not being absorbed, right? So again, I have the advantage, I can look outside and I can see these big green plants out there. You know, you think about green plants, and I think the person off the street, if you asked them what colors of light do plants use, they'd say, well, green, of course, because they're green, right? Well, that's just the opposite. They don't use green because they're green, because they're reflecting the green, they're absorbing the blues and the reds. So those are the wavelengths that they use. So that's what we're interested in. How do we absorb those wavelengths? How do we put them to use? So it's going to be what we don't see that we're using, not what we do see. So, where do we go from here? I think before I dive us into energy collection, let me talk just real briefly with you about what a chloroplast looks like. So we know chloroplast is where photosynthesis occurs, right? We talked about that earlier on in the quarter. We really didn't look at what the structure of a chloroplast looks like. So let's start with that. Then I'll tell you where energy gathering is going on in the chloroplast. Then we'll talk about where we're using that energy to fix it into sugar in the chloroplast. So if we were to look carefully at a picture of a chloroplast, we'd see something like this, maybe. Chloroplasts tend to have a variety of shapes. They tend to be oblongish like that, oval in shape, most of them. So already you're thinking, oh, that kind of looks like a mitochondrion. Mitochondria are much, much smaller than the chloroplast. Chloroplasts tend to be really large. And of course, when you looked at the cells with the light microscope way back in lab 3, whatever it was, you could see the chloroplasts, right? They were really easy to see. You couldn't see the mitochondria. So they're much, much larger structures. They also have a double membrane like the mitochondrion had. Now remember the mitochondrion, the membrane on the outside, and then the inner membrane poking in, the Christi poking in, the advantage being more surface area for reactions that needed that environment. We're going to see a similar thing with the chloroplast, but its own version of that. So what we'll see is this outer membrane, and then there will be an inner membrane, and it will have these extensions up in, but they're much more organized than maybe we see. And this is a terrible drawing already, I can just tell. We are in trouble. Oh, now we're really in trouble. Oh, why? Okay, I'm just going to draw a couple of those. And you can imagine, we'll look at some pictures in just a minute, that the chloroplast is going to be filled with these. Now, remember in mitochondria, these were called Christi. Well, we can't call these Christi because they're doing a whole different thing. They've got different proteins in their membranes and so forth, so never call two different things the same thing. These have a wonderful name. These pokings in, as it were, from this inner membrane are called thylakoids. Thylakoids. Now, about any chloroplast we look at is going to be filled with these thylakoids that are kind of poking in like that. And they're providing extra surface area, right, for reactions that have to happen. We'll see in a minute that all the energy collecting reactions, all the energy gathering reactions, are going to be happening because of proteins and molecules embedded in the thylakoids. So having extra surface area like that really increases our ability to harvest energy from the sun. In higher plants, we find that it's even a little more complicated, and that's kind of why I drew this way, and that there are also little stacks of thylakoids that run between. Okay, and these stacks, one stack is called a granum, so that's singular. And if we're talking about more of them, we would call them grana. That's plural, so single granum, plural grana. And these provide us with even more surface area, right, so that we can collect even more energy from the molecules that are embedded there. So we got all of these membranes on the inside, and then we have the water-based material on the inside. So in the cell, we call it the cytoplasm, right? In the mitochondrion, we called it the matrix. What are we going to call it in the chloroplast, where we have yet a whole different assortment of enzymes that are going to be involved in taking that carbon dioxide and building it into sugar? And so in the chloroplast, it's called the stroma. So the stroma is, again, that water-based fluid full of proteins, enzymes that are going to build the sugars from the carbon dioxide.
Okay, I'll show you a picture. Here's a picture now of what we were trying to draw. Look at this one first. That's a transmission electron micrograph, high magnification, and this is even a higher magnification in one region of it. And what you can see here is the outer membrane, this kind of limiting the whole structure. And then the inner membrane, you can see these little thylakoids running in between. Don't even try to draw this. You can see the little thylakoids, and then you can see these darker areas which are the granite. And here's what one of those might be. Higher magnification. You get just a stack of little sack-like structures that are piled one on top of the next, one on the next, one on top of the next, to form the ground. Again, the advantage of that is it's giving us a whole lot more surface area on which we can do what we need to do. This would be an artist's idea of what that would look like in three dimensions. So you can see that, and this would be a higher plant chloroplast. You can see this is a really busy place. Lots of thylakoids in there, lots of granule stacks in there, and so forth. A very, very busy place with stroma being the fluid in the middle. So that's what we're talking about. Anytime you see a picture that looks kind of like this, you know, okay, that's chloroplast. You know, compare that if you can remember what the mitochondria looks like in an electron micrograph, and there you've got the little things going in and out. Now, we don't see this kind of detail in the mitochondria by any means. So that's a chloroplast. Now, like I've said, energy collection is going to take place on these inner membranes. So they have embedded in them a certain assortment of molecules. And you already can begin guessing at what some of those might be, right? Because we talked about pigments. Pigments being the molecules that absorb the light energy. Well, they're going to be embedded in these membranes. And in fact, there will be whole groups of pigments that have the ability to, once they've absorbed the light energy, to transfer that energy around until it gets to one particular pigment that's responsible for passing that energy off. So we've got the pigments in there. We've got some other enzymes embedded in those membranes also, just like we did in the mitochondria. And then again in the stroma, that's once we've manufactured and gathered the energy, that's where we're going to use the energy, is in the stroma. Now let's look at this diagram on page 47. Sure. Let's look at this diagram on page 47 that I don't have.
Very good. Okay. Okay, this has been called the Z scheme. Because I guess it looks like a Z on its side. I don't know why they didn't call it the N scheme or something like that, but it's always, it goes by that name. If you talk about, if you refer to the Z scheme, then people who know about photosynthesis will know exactly what you're talking about. It's also an energy diagram. I guess that's the best reason for not turning it on its side. It's an energy diagram again, where this would be the high energy, and then this would be the low energy on this particular diagram. So we're going from low energy to high energy on this diagram. Now remember, with energy collection, we talked about last time how we need, there are two things that we need to collect that are going to drive photosynthesis. One of those things was ATP. Right, so we're going to be watching here. Where's the ATP being made? Because we need a lot of ATP to drive the formation of sugars. And the other thing that we needed was high energy electrons, a source of high energy electrons to build into the glucose molecule. So we're going to be watching, where are those high energy electrons coming from, and how in the world are they becoming high energy electrons in the first place? That's what's going to interest us. Now I want to take a look at this kind of backwards. We're going to go from right to left instead of left to right. So we'll kind of look at the output side before the input side. So let's focus over here with what I call photosystem 1. You notice the photosystems are numbered backwards. That's because photosystem 1 was identified before photosystem 2 was discovered. So people knew about photosystem 1 for a long time, but they knew there had to be something else. And then they finally identified the second photosystem. So there are actually a couple of events that are involved here in order to get our electrons up to the energy levels they need to be. Both of these photosystems are, if you can imagine, a little sea of pigment molecules sitting in the membrane. So they're lipid-soluble, they will sit within the membrane, and they're an assortment of different kinds of pigments in there. When I showed you that at the end, looked at the light spectrum and so forth, and I showed you what wavelengths chlorophyll was absorbing, I actually talked about chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. And so we recognize the fact that chlorophyll, you always think of, well, chlorophyll is the photosynthetic pigment, and chlorophyll's A and B, slightly different in structure, slightly different in the wavelengths of light that they'll absorb, are ultimately what are going to be doing the work. But then I mentioned other pigments too, like the carotenoids, beta-carotene, xanthophylls. You don't need to worry about those names. Just be aware that there are other pigments involved. And so when we look at a photosystem, it's really a bunch of these different pigments put together in real close proximity to each other. And any one of them that happens to absorb light, that energy can be transferred around to other ones, and ultimately that energy winds up in a chlorophyll molecule. And in photosystem 1, we call that molecule P700. And it's a version of chlorophyll that absorbs, the 700 refers to the wavelength, the maximum wavelength of light that it will absorb, where it's got a maximum out in the red. So P700. It all gets transferred around to this chlorophyll. So what have we got going on? We got light energy that's striking this photosystem. And if we were to examine the granules or the phyllopoids, and if we could actually, we had the capability of looking at very high magnification, we'd see that the granules and phyllopoids are just speckled with these photosystems. And they're just all over the place. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these embedded into those membranes that are harvesting the energy. So light energy gets absorbed, it gets transferred around, it winds up with P700, and that raises the energy level of an electron. So what we're actually, these arrows that we're seeing move through here are tracking the movement of electrons between the photosystems in the thylakoids and grana of the chloroplast. We're tracking the movement of electrons. And so there's an electron, a particular electron in P700 that will get excited to a very high energy level, and then it gets kind of plucked off. Okay, it actually is removed from the chlorophyll and picked up by a molecule that we call Z. Not quite sure exactly what that molecule is yet, though people are really starting to focus in, and I think that, that some definitive answers are going to be coming over the next few years as to what that molecule might be. But it's going to pick up these high energy electrons. And what it will do then is pass those high energy electrons, maybe directly, maybe through an intermediate, it's not really clear, but ultimately those high energy electrons are going to be placed into a high energy electron carrier. So we're going to have a molecule that's going to be able to pick them up. Now, remember we've already dealt with two high energy electron carriers, right? The NAD plus can pick up high energy electrons, and FAD can pick up high energy electrons of only slightly less energy than the NAD plus can pick up. Well, we can't use either of those this time because the energy level of these electrons has to be higher than the energy level that we find them at in the glucose. Because remember, nothing's 100% efficient. So we're going to build these into glucose. We're going to have a little bit higher because we're going to lose some energy as we're building them into the glucose. And because of that, you might say, well, can't we use NAD plus? No, we can't. Instead, we use another very, very closely related molecule that you see here, NADP plus. And that just means it's got an extra phosphate group on it. Now, remember back to the structure of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and there were those three phosphates that were connected off to the end, and it was cleaving one of those bonds that gave us the energy. So this extra phosphate that we see here is the same kind of thing, and by having it attached to the NAD molecule, it means that the electrons that it can pick up have to be higher energy than if that phosphate weren't attached to the NAD. So it gives us the ability now to pick up these higher yet energy electrons, and that's exactly what's going on here. So we're taking these electrons that have been, their energy level's been raised by absorbing light, passed around, gets to the chlorophyll, raises the energy, picked up by Z, passed on down, and what we get output then is NADPH. So NADPH is the reduced version of our carrier, and when you see NADPH, you should recognize that we've got a pair of high energy electrons now that are being carried that we can use now to build our sugar from up from the carbon dioxide. So that was one of the things we said, we need a source of high energy electrons. Well, there's our source of high energy electrons. Where's the energy coming from? Sunlight. Right? It's the absorption of sunlight, or light in general, that is increasing the energy of those electrons, and then we're capturing those high energy electrons and we'll use them to make the sugar. But we have a problem. Okay, can anybody see the problem here? How long can we continue to harvest high energy electrons from this chlorophyll? See, we're going to run out because every time we do that, we've got more and more chlorophyll molecules that have given up their electrons. And it's just like kind of like back when we were looking at cytochrome chain in the mitochondria, at that point, if we couldn't get rid of the low energy electrons, we were in trouble. At this point, if we can't replace the electrons that we're passing on, we're in trouble. And so that's where the second photosystem comes from. So in order to replace those electrons that are being lost out of the P700, we're going to be getting them from this other photosystem. Very similar. It's an assortment of various pigments and so forth that have the ability to transfer, once they've absorbed the energy, transfer it around and so forth. And it's going to wind up ultimately in the P680, which is another chlorophyll. Has slightly different characteristics from the P700. And so that's why it's used here rather than over here. So as we shine light on it, We're going to excite electrons, and those electrons now are flowing here. Again, it's electrons that are flowing. Those are going to be picked up by a molecule that has been called Q for various reasons. It has nothing to do with James Bond. Okay, it's just Q. Now, how do we get them from here to here? There's a cytochrome chain. And they're very different cytochromes from what we found in the mitochondria. But they behave the same. They're proteins that have at their heart iron ions that can go between +2 and +3. They can pick up electrons. They can transfer those electrons, pass them to the next, to the next, to the next. And as they pass them down, those high-energy electrons lose energy. So there's a series of cytochromes they get passed through. And very analogous to what goes on in the mitochondrion, as a result of that, we're able to make ATP. So by passing these high-energy electrons from Q down to photosystem 1, we're releasing that energy and we're going to make ATP. And there's at least one position along the way where ATP is made. It's not clear exactly whether there's more than one, but there's at least one position where ATP is being made along the way. So that was the other thing. I said we need ATP, right? We need a good supply of ATP in order to build our molecules. So there's our supply of ATP. We've now got a source of energy. We've got a source of high-energy electrons. So these electrons excited coming out of photosystem 2, pass down the cytochromes, get picked up by photosystem 1 to replace these electrons that are excited and are being removed from photosystem 1 and being harvested in the NADPH molecule. We still have a problem though, right? And that is that we're losing electrons now from photosystem 2. So how are we going to replace them? Turns out that those electrons are going to come from water. So there's an enzyme complex in the chloroplast that literally will take water, will split it apart, releasing the oxygen and hydrogen ions, and will pump those low-energy electrons into photosystem 1. I'm sorry, photosystem 2. I remember it was low-energy electrons that we used in the mitochondria, combined it with oxygen and hydrogen ions to form water, right? So these are definitely low-energy electrons, but they're perfect for what we need here in order to replace these electrons that are being lost out of photosystem 2. So we've kind of completed the cycle here now, where in a two-step process, we can take these electrons that are coming from the water, we can raise their energy level once, and then a second time even higher, and then harvest those high-energy electrons. In the process, we can make some ATP, and there's a plentiful supply of water. I don't have to worry too much about that. Most plants really under difficult conditions. The oxygen, that's a waste product. The oxygen, it's thought that all the oxygen that we have in the atmosphere has come as the result of plant activity, photosynthetic activity, producing oxygen this way, that's being given off as a waste product from this process. People, when they first figured this out, were really surprised. They didn't have a clue that the oxygen was going to come from water. They thought it was going to come from carbon dioxide, because we're taking carbon with two oxygens, and we're going to take six of them, so there are 12 oxygens, and we're going to make a sugar that has only six oxygens. People thought for sure that that's where the oxygen was coming from. And one of the big benefits of the nuclear program during World War II was the formation of development of nuclear isotopes, radioactive isotopes, and heavy isotopes of atoms that became available after World War II to the scientific community. And so there's an isotope of oxygen that's called heavy oxygen. And when people started looking to say, okay, where is that oxygen coming from? Let's label the carbon dioxide with heavy oxygen and see if that oxygen that's being produced has heavy oxygen in it. And when they did that, it didn't. It's like, uh-oh, where's it? Then they tried labeling the water with heavy oxygen. And then they started to see, oh, the heavy oxygen is coming out now. in the form of oxygen gas. That's how they figured out that that oxygen is actually coming from water and not the carbon dioxide. Okay, so that's our energy harvesting. And the end products then that are so important to us are the NADPH, the high energy electrons, and the ATP. That only happens in the light. Almost instantly, when you turn the lights off, this whole process shuts down because it depends upon energy from the light to make it happen. And you can literally see that there. I don't know if you ever noticed sometimes, like in an aquarium, if you've got live aquarium plants in there, sometimes you can look in and if there's been a bright light shining on it, you'll see little bubbles on the leaves of the aquarium plants. That's oxygen that's being given off by those plants. Sometimes if you see a little broken stem, oftentimes they'll be kind of hollow in the stem, and you can actually watch oxygen bubbles bubble off from a broken stem in an aquarium. And then if you shut the lights off, you'll see that almost instantly that oxygen is going to quit bubbling off. So it's almost instantaneous in shutting down once the light goes out. Absolutely requires light. Okay, any questions about that aspect, about the energy collection that we need? And we'll use it in just a second. We're taking those low energy electrons, we're raising them in energy in the two photosystems using light and passing them through cytochromes and so forth. It's happening. Now, I would say this is like higher plants, and there are probably at least a couple of other types of photosystems that we find with algae and some of the other lower plants and so forth. But this is the classic higher plant type thing. There are some of them where they really only have a single photosystem. They don't have two of them. So they behave a little bit differently. It doesn't. We're just collecting energy right now. Right now we're going to make use of the energy. So
this is where your question comes
in. So that's collecting energy. Now the second part of photosynthesis then is what I called last time carbon fixation. Or you might think of these as the carbon reactions. And that's over on page 48. And for that, we'll just use this diagram. Okay, this is called the Calvin cycle. The Calvin cycle. No, it's not named after Calvin and Hobbes. It's named after a very famous biochemist who first came up with an idea in the early 50s is how to figure out what was going on. It turns out to be a pretty complicated system. I mean, I've shown it really simply as kind of a cycle, and I didn't even put names on it and so forth because I don't think we need to worry about that in this class. But it really is an elegant and complex system of shifting molecules around, going anywhere from 3 carbon to 7 carbon sugars and intermediates and back and forth and around and so forth. So what we're going to look at is just the, you know, it's the Reader's Digest 2-minute version of what goes on in terms of fixing carbon. What happens is, so here's where the carbon dioxide comes in. We'll take a carbon dioxide molecule and we'll combine it with a 5-carbon sugar to form a 6-carbon sugar, which almost immediately breaks down into 2 3-carbon sugars. You don't even see the 6-carbon sugar referenced here. Okay, it almost immediately breaks down. And then these 3-carbon sugars get massaged and changed and all sorts of other things going on, and ultimately we'll get out 1/6 of a glucose molecule and we'll come back to our 5-carbon sugar again. So that's why it's a cycle. It's just like in the mitochondria, except we kept coming back to 4-carbon acid, right? The oxalic acid. Here we're coming back to a 5-carbon sugar. And that's ready to pick up another carbon dioxide. And it just keeps doing this and doing this. Now, to be honest, you can't get a sixth of a glucose molecule. You get a whole glucose molecule. So in order to make this work, we're going to put through actually six CO2s through different condensations here. Okay, so we'll take six of these and we'll take six of these and combine them, and then we've got all this biochemical process that's going on. So those six will immediately break down to the three carbon sugars and blah, 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 and so forth. And so what we'll get out, if we're including six of those, we'll get out a glucose molecule. So that's where we're taking our six CO2, and we're converting that into a C6H12O6. In essence, it takes six cycles of the Calvin cycle to make a glucose molecule. But it's like modern-day computers where you've got parallel processors going on now. You've got four cores, you've got eight, you've got 12 cores, and so forth. That's what's going on here. You've got thousands of these happening simultaneously. And then the initial products being modified and modified and ultimately getting back our 5-carbon sugar again that we can go ahead and reuse. Now you notice in this reaction, it doesn't say anything about generating oxygen. And yet we know oxygen is one of the products over here, but we saw that the oxygen is coming from the light reactions, right? From the energy harvesting reactions. So that's where that's coming from. And water gets confused in here all over the place anyway, so I don't want to talk about that, but we also know that water is needed over there in the energy generating reactions. To make this happen, now think about what we extracted from the glucose when we were breaking it down to carbon dioxide. So we extracted a lot of energy. Right? We use that energy to make ATP. Well, here, for each cycle, we're going to need to put in three ATP. So we'll have three of these ATPs being broken down to form ADP plus inorganic phosphate, because we're getting the energy out. So in order to make one glucose, let's look down here, that means three times, that means that we need 18 ATPs, and we're just using the energy from them. So that's just raw energy. Well, what about the hydrogen electrons? Remember how many pair of hydrogen electrons we collected out of the glucose when we broke it down for the carbon dioxide? What was that number? Come on, where are my accountants? Aren't there any business majors here? And that's the sort of thing that business majors would love to know. 12 pair. The answer is 12. We got 12 pair out, that means we got to put 12 pair back in. Right. So it's going to take 12 NADPH that are going to give up 12 pair high energy electrons that are going to be built into this, and then plus 12 NADP plus. So that means that for every cycle we're using two NADPH, we're using two pair of high energy electrons to actually build every carbon dioxide into the glucose. We're using the energy from three ATPs. Now, if you wanted to look at that and say, okay, how much energy? What's the equivalent? You know, we talked about how we got 36 net ATPs out of breaking down the glucose. Well, what's the equivalent here? So if we were to assume that we could, that was nice, we were to assume that we could put these pairs of high energy electrons from the NADPH through a cytochrome chain similar to what we saw in the mitochondria, and if we were to assume that we would still get three ATPs out per pair of high energy electrons like we do from NADH, then we could say that these 12 NADPHs are worth 36 ATP right there, and then we use another 18 here, so the total would be 54 ATP equivalents. That we're needing to use to make the glucose, and when we break it down, then what we get back out is 36 ATPs that we can use. So again, you can see this idea of energy loss. You know, nothing's 100% efficient. You've always got to put more energy in than you're going to get out when you're building something like this. But we really don't. That's just kind of a mind game here. You know, what would we get? So that's our process of photosynthesis. You need to be familiar with this. This, by the way, isn't until what, the fourth grade, so don't worry about that. This, you need to be familiar with energy harvesting. You need to be familiar with kind of what's going on here in terms of building that carbon dioxide into glucose. How much energy does it take? How many pair of energy electrons does it take, and so forth? Those are the sorts of things that would kind of be the take-home lessons for this. Questions? I know you're all disappointed that I didn't go into a lot more detail on this. I think you've had enough detail for a while. Okay, I just have a couple more things to say then about this whole idea of that we've been looking at respiration and photosynthesis and things like that. So let me see if I can. You don't forget about it. We talked about the relationship between photosynthesis and respiration, and how one looks like it's the reverse of the other, even though the processes are very, very different, and how you get to the end products, that one looks like it's the reverse of the other. And so we could kind of sketch them out like this. If that's photosynthesis and this is respiration, should say cellular. Cellular respiration is really the proper term, even though generally we refer to it as respiration. Don't let that be confused with the respiratory system and the process of respiration, breathing in and breathing out. So those are our two processes. And we see now that photosynthesis produces sugars. Like I said, the plants are going to take these sugars, the glucose. They're going to build it in cell walls. They're going to build it in this and that. They're going to convert it into amino acids. They're going to build it into oils, if you store oils. Just, you know, it's just a plethora of things that they're going to do with that, that we're going to take advantage of. We'll just focus on the sugars. Sugars plus oxygen, right? That's the output of photosynthesis. And, of course, that's what we need input for cellular respiration. Right, so we depend upon that oxygen coming from plants. We depend upon those sugars, ultimately, at least at the initial stage, coming from plants. That's how we get our organic molecules. That's where the energy that we take advantage of comes from, is that sugar captured by the created by the plants. We take those and break them down, and we form carbon dioxide and water. Okay, so that's what we're making, and of course, that's what plants need in order to do photosynthesis. So there's this kind of closed loop between the processes where the plants are providing us with what we need, and we're just not to just take advantage of them, we're being the good guys and providing them with what they need. If all of the carbon got tied up as sugars and stuff, if none of it ever got broken down, then it wouldn't be long, and photosynthesis would stop because there'd be no more supply of carbon dioxide. You've got to have both of these processes going. And it's nice if there's a bit of a balance between the two. Actually, here's a diagram. It's basically the same. Diagram that I showed you, but it kind of shows that interrelationship at the chloroplast mitochondria. A balance. Now, it's important to remember that plants we always focus on photosynthesis as the process. Plants also respire. One of the things they're making that sugar for is so that when the lights go out, they can continue meeting their energy needs. So they'll take some of that sugar and they'll break it right back down by cellular respiration in the dark, and they'll continue meeting their energy needs through the night until the lights come on again. And when the lights are on, it's just really hard to separate out respiration and photosynthesis because of what's going on. But certainly in the dark, they will respire, and they'll use that. So plants do both photosynthesis and respiration. Animals only do respiration, right? So we are dependent upon the plants for energy, for carbon molecules, for all of those kinds of things. We don't photosynthesize. Only the plants and the algae and some bacteria have the ability to photosynthesize, to take energy from light, to tie it up into chemical bonds in molecules, and to make that available to the rest of the world. So we have this kind of an interplay that's going on between the two processes. And that's what we see. Now you think, well, okay, what's going on now where plants are drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere photosynthetically, but we're seeing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere going up. All right, and that's a concern. The whole concern with climate change caused by increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Well, a lot of that carbon dioxide actually is coming from sources that we can't control. The question is, how much of this is coming from sources that we might actually be able to control? And what we've seen in the last few centuries with modern farming and industrialization and so forth is that we take advantage of photosynthetically produced products. So there are a lot of photosynthetically produced products like oils and wood and coal and things like that that have just been kind of stored away. Okay, they're off to the side. We call them storage. They're off to the side. They're not doing anything. And we come along and we take advantage of those by burning them. And when we burn them, we're doing the analogous of cellular respiration, except we're releasing all the energy as heat and light. Right, we talked about that way back when. If we were to burn the sugar, that's what you would get out. So we take advantage of that heat that's being released. We make our engines run. We heat our houses. We do all that stuff. But in the process, we're releasing CO2. And that's where some of that, at least some of that atmospheric CO2, is coming from. And CO2 is one of a group of components in the atmosphere that we call greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are kind of like a blanket around the Earth. Greenhouse gases are absolutely necessary for life as we understand it. If we got rid of all the greenhouse gases, the planet would be too cold to sustain life. So we need that blanket around the Earth. The question is, how thick should that blanket be? And as more and more CO2 gets put into the atmosphere, that thickens the blanket. And you know what happens if you have too heavy a blanket on your bed at night, and you wake up in the middle of the night sweating or something because you've collected too much heat from that thick blanket. So that's one of the concerns that people have is how much of that is what's called anthropomorphic, which means that it's human caused. And then another question that you have to ask, even if you decide that a certain percent of it's anthropomorphic, what's the potential for actually reducing that? And that raises some very interesting other questions and so forth. Anyway, that's a debate for another time. Those of you that are in Biology 103, that you may get to hear something about that. I'm not sure what's going to happen this year. Okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to move into that other area. Let's get started again. So, I told you I was going to turn a corner now, and that's what we're going to do. So we're kind of going to put away all of the metabolism kinds of things and things like that, and start looking at DNA, information, how do we, what's it all about, How do we make use of that information? How do we pass that information on from cell to cell or generation to generation? Not so much generation. Well, it depends on whether you're a single cell organism or not. So it could be generation to generation or cell to cell or whatever. And that's what we've got left for the rest of the term. So that's where we're headed in the next few lectures. For centuries, philosophers and others marveled at how offspring looked similar to the parents. And they tried to figure out what's going on. Why is that? What makes that happen, that your offspring looks so similar? And you can see this in family lineages. Lots of families, of course, there's a lot of variation too. Lots of families, wow, the kids and the grandkids just, you know, look so much alike and like the parents. Of course, there are situations where you look at them and say, they don't look anything alike, but we're not going to go down that path right now. Traits, both physical and behavioral traits, seem to be passed on through family lineages. So it's not just what people look like, but certain kinds of behaviors and so forth would get passed on through family lineages. Some of those good, some of those bad. Came to be recognized that these traits are passed on by means of what people began to call hereditary factors. Hereditary factors. Now, okay, what in the world could these be? It wasn't known where the information was stored in the organism. Like, hereditary factors have to be information. Right? Where is that stored? How's it passed on, and so forth? And so there were a lot of questions that people might ask. And you've got to list them. You know, where are they? Where are the hereditary factors in a cell? Where are they kept? Well, we benefit from, you know, looking back and say, well, I know where they're stored now and so forth. But people didn't know that until kind of the recent history. What are their hereditary factors really responsible for? Is it just controlling what the next generation looks like, or is it other things? You know, what are we using them for? What are they? These things that we call hereditary factors. What in the world are they? And how do they work? And those are kind of the questions that we're going to be looking at here too, as we go through, at least early on, thinking about this. The lack of information, people sitting just trying to figure this out, the lack of information brought out all sorts of really interesting theories as to how the hereditary factors, where they came from, how they might work, and so forth. And so a couple of the more interesting ones, I think. One was called the blending theory. The blending theory, and the idea here was that you had little hereditary factors that were formed in all different parts of the body, and they would then accumulate from all over the body into the sex cells, and they'd get passed on that way. So that's where the idea of blending comes from. So that what was getting passed on was a blend of all of these different characteristics that were literally. Traveling from all parts in the body and then focusing into the sex cells. So, blending theory. Another one that's kind of a subset of this in a way, or one's a subset of the other, was one called acquired inheritance. Acquired inheritance. In other words, you could acquire traits during your lifetime which would then get passed on to your offspring, which was an interesting theory. And people would always look to the old blacksmith or somebody like that that's doing a lot of hard physical labor and say, oh, look at this guy. He is really muscular and strong. He's acquired these traits through what he does, and he's going to pass that on to his offspring because he's acquired them. Now, there was a Russian, oh, gosh, when was it? Not maybe 50, 60 years ago, that really took this theory to task and thought, okay, if acquired inheritance really works, then I should be able to modify an organism. And that should be inheritable, right? So he took mice, and he would cut their tails off. So if acquired inheritance, or even if the blending theory, you know, if we were collecting all of these things from different parts of the body, that would mean that the next generation of mice should have no tails, right? Because he cut the tails off. That's an acquired characteristic. He did that for like 50 generations or something. Proved emphatically that just cutting the tail off the mouse does not mean that the next generation is going to be tailless. So there went acquired inheritance out the door. Actually, it had gone out the door long before that, but that was kind of a weird experiment that was done that demonstrated that. So different ideas. You know, you're observing what's going on. You're trying to figure out why is it the way that it is. We all do that. Every one of you has done that with the natural world around you. You, on your own, whether you realize it or not, you've figured out how certain things work. You have theories about how certain things work. They may be correct, they may be totally incorrect, but they're kind of naive theories about how things work. And that's kind of what these things were that they were looking at. Now remember in the mid-1800s, the cell theory. So let's come back to the cell theory for a minute. We talked about that a few lectures ago. The idea that the cell is the minimal unit of life, right? And that all cells come from pre-existing cells. Those are the two parts of the cell theory that we talked about. So it became obvious that the hereditary factors probably existed at the level of the cell. If the cell is going to be the minimal unit of life, then it has to have all of the information in it that's necessary to make life happen, right? So it's the assumption then being, well, it must be at the unit of the cell maybe where we find these hereditary factors. It doesn't solve the problem of blending or those other kinds of things, but it gave people a place to begin looking. Okay, let's focus on the cell. But then these questions were still outstanding that we've got here. Where are we going to look in the cell? Because we don't know what the hereditary factors are. So where are we going to look? What are they? We don't know what they are. What are they? Maybe if we knew where to look, we could figure out what they are. Of course, the opposite is true, too. If we knew what they were, we might know where to look. How are they passed on? How do they work? Again, that list of questions that we're going to be going through are questions that have been solved over the decades in looking at the hereditary factors and what they are and how they work. So, I want to start chipping away on those questions with you. I want to give you some of the classical experiments that we've done that eventually led us down the path to where we are today, and maybe a little bit about where we're headed. So the question of where is fairly easy to get at. You know, where in the cell are the hereditary factors lodged? And there were some real classical experiments that were done that helped to demonstrate that. Now, an unfertilized egg, let's talk about that for a minute. An unfertilized egg is full of stuff. It's full of proteins. It's full of other materials. It's full of organelles. It's full of everything that that's needed for that to develop once it comes time to develop. But it's kind of like the switch has been turned off. It's like unfertilized, okay, there's an on switch and an off switch, then unfertilized egg is turned off. So if you were to see how metabolically active is it? You know, so we've been talking about metabolism here. Now, how much carbon dioxide is it taking up? Very little, because very little is going on inside an unfertilized egg. How much oxygen is it taking up? Very little. Not much is going on. The interesting thing, though, is as soon as a fertilized egg becomes fertilized, it's like the switch has been turned on. And all of a sudden, it starts to take up a lot of oxygen. It starts to give off a lot of carbon dioxide. It starts to take up maybe other things from the environment, depending on the environment that it is, what kind of egg it is, and so forth. It's like the switch is now turned on, and events start to happen. It becomes very metabolically active. It begins to divide. It begins ultimately to form a new individual. In those early stages of the development of a new individual kind of look like this. So if we take a fertilized egg, which we would call at this point a zygote. So here's our fertilized egg, got a nice nucleus, even a nucleolus, by golly. There's our fertilized egg. It's going to start to divide. And yeah, we're still there on page 50, where you have nowhere to write. It's going to divide in two. So we would call this actually the two-cell stage. And these cells generally divide pretty much in synchrony early on, so they would divide again, and we're going to wind up with four cells. And the nucleus is just getting a little sloppier there. So four-cell stage. And I'm not going to keep drawing these out, but we wind up with an eight-cell stage. Where now we've got eight cells there, and with this, they keep dividing and dividing. We wind up with a solid ball of cells. That ball will start to hollow out. We get a hollow ball of cells. All sorts of things start to happen. And eventually, we would wind up with an individual, a new individual, which you would recognize as, oh, there's an individual. Okay. So that's the early developmental pathway. Now, people looked at that and they thought, okay, clearly all of the hereditary factors have to be in the fertilized egg, right? Because that's going to form the new individual. Now, can we isolate where in that? Or there are a bunch of different questions we could ask, you know, where. One of the questions that was asked early on by Hans Driesch, and this was the late 1880s. One of the questions he asked was, every time that fertilized egg divides, every time a cell divides there, is the hereditary information being distributed in those new cells? So that every cell just has the information that it needs? Or what's happening? Maybe the hereditary information is actually passing on in its complete form to new cells, or what's going on? So it's just kind of a basic question. He looked at this and he said, I wonder what would happen if I were to take this at the two-cell stage and separate those two cells apart. Would they continue to grow? Would they stop growing because there's only half of them there? If they continued to grow, would they only form half an organism? Because there's only one of the two cells, would they form a full organism and so forth? A fairly simple question to ask. He was doing this with sea urchin embryos. Sea urchins are great things to work with. They're the little spiny things that you really don't want to come into contact with them too much down in a tide pool, because the spines can be kind of sharp. You definitely don't want to get jabbed by one of them, because you can get an infection. But they're just kind of hanging out there. They eat algae and other things off the rocks. And it's real easy to simulate them to give up their eggs and their sperm. So you can mix them together in the lab, and then you can do some experiments with it. So that's what Driesch was doing. So he'd take a fertilized egg, and he'd let it go just to the two-cell stage. That happens after about an hour. So now we've got two cells, and then he separated the two. So now we have two cells separate. And the question was, what was going to be the fate of those cells? A real basic question. And this kind of gets at this whole question of the hereditary factors too. You know, what's going on with them? What he discovered was that when he did this time and time again, he wound up getting, this would turn into a normal urchin. And this would turn into a normal urchin. So he'd get two normal urchins. Now that tells us something. This gives us some really interesting information. Not only is the hereditary material at the level of the cell, we've already figured out it had to be because it was in the zygote, but each one of these two cells had the complete set of hereditary material. Right, so we had a complete set that we started with here, and now each of these two cells has a complete set of the hereditary material. Yeah? Something happens to cause the two cells to separate, and we wind up with two genetically identical. That doesn't mean that they're going to be absolutely identical, and we know more and more about why that is now. But from the DNA standpoint, two genetically identical individuals. So, yeah. And in fact, he asked this question, he thought, okay, it works in the two-cell stage, let's try the four-cell stage, and it works there, too. But it doesn't work any farther. Because you're just running out of material in the cells. There's not enough material to carry it through. So that's the limitation there. So even at the four-cell stage, each of those cells has the complete set of information. So that tells us that every time one of those cells divides, that something happens. I mean, we're assuming that there's not a repository of copies of the hereditary factors so they can just keep divvying them out, right? Every time a cell divides, before it can divide, that hereditary information has to be copied inside the cell. So that's what it tells us. And a lot of other experiments have been done much, much later, and we've demonstrated that, yeah, this just carries through. And in fact, if we were to examine your own body cells, we'd find that every one of your body cells has the same DNA, except for mutations that may have accumulated, as every other body cell, except for some really weird things that might happen. In general, that's what happens. Yeah.
All the cells are going in like double numbers and even numbers.
Well, triplets could be non-identical, right? Or it could be that if they were at a four-cell stage, and that's getting pretty dicey for you, but if they were there, at that point somehow separated. Okay, so interesting experiment that he did, and we're adding a little bit to our information. Now, another important point to make is he did this in the 1880s, and it wasn't until the 1890s that people were really interested in trying to figure out what was going on in the nucleus. They were seeing chromosomes, they were watching chromosomes divide, separate out in cells and so forth. They still didn't know what was going on there, so we really didn't have any idea of where in the cell. From this experiment, where in the cell the hereditary factors might be, but we knew that they were getting copied and they were being passed on to the new cells. So, in the early 1900s, along comes Hans Shneeman. Sorry, I didn't capitalize. Okay, Hans Shneeman, he was working with salamander embryos. And by now, people were kind of looking at that nucleus and thinking, what is that nucleus doing? Why is it that when a cell divides, all this activity happens around the nucleus, and then we get a division and the nuclei reform and so forth? And so people were interested in knowing. So here's Shneeman comes along, and he takes a fertilized egg. Okay, so this is a zygote. Takes a zygote, and he literally took a human hair and carefully tied this zygote in half. So now we're not cutting it in half or anything like that. We're not waiting till the two-cell stage. We're taking the zygote and we're going to cut it tie it in half in such a way. So that the nucleus is in one side. We're going to tie it so tight that the nucleus can't go back and forth, but other cellular components can. So if, let me just go ahead. So now we've tied it with this hair, and I just can't imagine some poor lab assistant sitting there tying embryo after embryo with their hair and so forth, but that's what they did. And so now they were asking the question, what's going to happen? And what they observed was that the embryo, the part of the embryo on the side with the nucleus would behave as a normal embryo. So it would divide and do all the normal embryo kinds of things. The part of the embryo without the nucleus would just sit there and pout. Wouldn't do anything. They thought, oh, does that mean the nucleus is where the hereditary factors are? Well, there's a problem with this that you have to solve, first of all. And you have to decide whether in the experimental procedure, did just tying it in half, did something happen that it damaged the side or whatever? Is it really not the presence of the nucleus but something else that's going on? And he was well aware of that. So what he did next, so he'd take, they had these little embryos developing like this, and he would take, and you have to be really careful, you can do this, you can take a nucleus from one of these cells over here and put it back into this side. So it's kind of like a nuclear transplant. Now, taking the nucleus from one of these cells is no big deal. If it dies, you've got enough cells, it'll compensate. But, you know, putting it over here, that was a very interesting question. So now we've got a nucleus on this side. What's going to happen? And it turns out that this side will continue to develop. And with the nucleus in it, this side will begin to develop. So it looks like it wasn't because he had damaged this side that it wasn't developing. It's because the nucleus was missing. And when the nucleus got put back in, then it began to develop. So conclusions of these, one is that the nucleus is required to develop, to direct the development. In other words, the hereditary factors were in the nucleus. And the second thing that he demonstrated even more emphatically than Driesch did was that the hereditary material is not diluted as cells divide. Because he could take a nucleus from over here when it divided multiple times and it would still direct the development. So they're not diluted with cell division. In other words, looking forward to the future, we're saying we've got to be making more of them as time goes on, right, before that cell can divide. Okay, let me leave you with that. Don't forget, 5 o'clock today, the fun begins. And see you all next week.